Nighttime. A passenger plane takes off from a runway.
At 12:42 a.m. on the 8th of March 2014, Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 takes off from Kuala Lumpur Airport. Its destination is Beijing.
This world.
Level 250, Malaysia 370.
239 passengers and crew are on board. 40 minutes into the flight, something extraordinary happens. The plane disappears from the radar of air traffic control.
There was no distress signals, no calls, no emergency.
We do not know what has happened to that aircraft.
Where is the plane and why did it vanish?
The area when the aircraft disappeared is really a black hole.
The disappearance of flight MH370 is the greatest unsolved mystery in aviation.
All of the questions we had on the 8th of March in 2014 have not been answered 10 years later. But if we find the plane, we will have all the answers.
10 years on, we investigate if new evidence can finally help locate the missing aircraft.
Aircraft do not vanish. They always leave a trail of breadcrumbs.
I am convinced this is from Malaysian 370.
And we ask what lessons can be learned to make aviation safer.
It's a passenger door?
Yes.
That's all you know?
We need to understand what happened, because 10 million people every single day climb on board a commercial aircraft and they expect to get to their destination.
Why planes vanish? The hunt for MH370. A bird's eye view of a vast city with towering skyscrapers, bustling traffic, and twinkling lights shining out into the night. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
I remember very clearly that evening he was scheduled on the flight to Beijing. Before his flight, well, he usually packs his bag and everything is ready by the door. He had fun time with his crew when they were overseas. It was just like any ordinary flight that he was going on. So we said, bye, see you later. That was it. And he went off happily. That was the last we saw of Patrick.
Jaquita Gonzalez, wife of MH370 crew member.
Friday the 7th of March 2014, Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Shortly before midnight, CCTV cameras capture crew and passengers passing through security to board Malaysia Airlines flight 370 bound for Beijing.
370. Recordings from air traffic control, 8th of March 2014. 370 32 right cleared for takeoff, good night. 32 right, cleared for takeoff, Malaysian 370. Thank you, bye.
On that night, MH370 departed from the gate C1. Then it took off normally.
An animation of flight MH370 taking off from the runway.
It was a normal flight following the filed flight plan. And it climbed, cleared by the air traffic management.
Malaysian 370, Lumpur Radar, good morning. Climb flight level 250.
The weather was fine and everything happened as normal as a standard flight.
MH370 cockpit. Malaysian 370 maintaining level 350.
On board the Boeing 777 are 227 passengers and 12 crew members. The cabin crew is led by Patrick Gomez.
My husband Patrick was the in-flight supervisor for Malaysian Airlines and took care of the crew members. We were childhood sweetheart, and from the time I met him until the last day I saw him, he was a joker. He was very loving and very caring. Anytime he comes back from flight, there will be gifts for his mom, for me. A wonderful guy.
Among the passengers on board is Anne Daisy. She's flying to Beijing to visit her husband, Navin, who works at the airport in air traffic control.
My wife used to come and visit me regularly. So on this occasion, she was coming to spend a couple of weeks with me in Beijing. The flight was departing after midnight. I went to bed before the flight departed. She sent me a WhatsApp message about the departure, and I left it. And I told her that I'll be at the airport to meet her the next morning.
Anne Daisy and Navin's eldest daughter, Grace, was a student in the UK at this time.
I remember speaking to my mom as she was getting ready to leave to the airport. So my mom and I, we were very close. We spoke every day, sometimes several times a day, and our conversations often lasted like more than an hour. We are quite a sort of a emotionally suppressed Asian family, quite typical of Asian families, where we only exchange things like I love yous in birthday cards. And on that particular occasion, she, for some reason, decided she wanted to tell me that she loved me, and I'm glad that I told her that I loved her too.
The flight time from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing is almost 6 hours. 40 minutes into its journey, MH370 approaches a flight navigation marker, or waypoint, known as Igari. It's at the border with Vietnamese airspace.
And then the air traffic controller from Kuala Lumpur told the aircraft to contact the Vietnamese sector.
Air traffic control says over the radio, Malaysian 370 contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Good night. MH370 cockpit replies, good night, Malaysian 370.
The communication with the air traffic controller was normal. The aircraft continued to fly, but didn't call the Vietnamese sector. Close to the transfer point called Igari, the aircraft disappeared.
Flight MH370 drops off the screens of both Malaysian and Vietnamese air traffic control without warning. 17 minutes pass before Vietnamese air traffic control realize that the plane is missing. In Kuala Lumpur, one of the first people to learn of the aircraft's disappearance is Malaysia Airlines crisis director, Fuad Sharuji.
The operations manager told me that our flight to Beijing, MH370, had gone missing. I thought it could have been a technical glitch. There was no messages that aircraft was turning back or calling for distress. No distress signals, no calls, no emergency. We tried to call the flight by various means, including through satellite communication, and none of them worked. When that happened, we knew that there's something really, really serious.
Malaysia Airlines now has an aircraft that's been missing from radar for more than an hour and is uncontactable. Where is the plane?
The time since last contact extends from 2 hours to 5 hours through the night and into the morning. Beijing International Airport. It's 6:30 a.m.
At the flight's destination in Beijing, families of passengers arrive to find an unexplained delay.
I got off the train, walked into the arrival hall, and looked for the arrival information, and there was no information on MH370. I walked up to the information counter to ask, and they had no information. I'm an air traffic controller, so I knew that the best place to obtain information would be the air traffic control center in Kuala Lumpur. And the guy who picked up the phone knew me personally. So he explained to me that they had lost communication. Then my first thought was that there's something wrong, seriously wrong with this plane. So I feared the worst.
A phone call from a contact named Dad.
My phone rang, and I remembered looking at the time thinking like, oh yeah, it's my mom that was calling because to tell me that she had arrived in Beijing. And I picked up the phone, but it was my dad. And I, at that point, from the tone of his voice, I knew something was wrong. I said, tell me what's going on. And then he said, something happened to the plane your mom was on. And that was it. So at that point, when he said that, I literally just grabbed my passport, grabbed my handbag, and put my laptop in a backpack, and I left the house because I wanted to get on the next flight to Malaysia.
More than 5 hours after the plane disappeared from air traffic controllers' radar screens, it's clear that something has gone very wrong with flight MH370.
Malaysia Airlines confirm that this flight, MH370, lost contact with Subang Air Traffic Control.
A rescue helicopter finishes fueling.
The Malaysian government assembles an international team and launches a search for the aircraft over the South China Sea.
The first thought is that the aircraft went down at the last known location, just after waypoint Igari in South China Sea. If the aircraft crashed, it's a very busy seaway. There are a lot of ships, cruisers, and debris would have been floating around. So it could have been seen. And we were quite sure that the aircraft would have been found on day one itself.
Helicopter pilots check their position on a map.
Day one turned to day two, turned to day three. Nothing was found.
A rescue boat sails across seemingly endless open water.
Every day it became a bigger and bigger puzzle.
I was just thinking, you know, where Patrick was. We waited and waited and waited. Every now and then, any news? Nothing yet, nothing yet. Just waiting for news, and they couldn't give us anything at all. You know, and my children were calling me and asking me what's going on. I tried not to say too much to them, but just tell them that everything is being done to find Dad and to bring him home hopefully soon.
MH370 has seemingly vanished without trace. But within 48 hours, a clue emerges. When scientists at a satellite company in London make an unexpected discovery. Inmarsat operates a global network of satellites. They provide communication links between planes and the ground, but do not track aircraft. One of these satellites, stationed above the Indian Ocean, has been receiving hourly automated signals from MH370.
We received information from Inmarsat data that the aircraft continued flying for another 7 more hours. From the point that we received the last contact from the aircraft.
The hourly signals identify the aircraft as MH370, but do not reveal its location or course.
Every hour, the Inmarsat system is asking, are you there? And the system on board the aircraft said, I'm there. And that's what we call a handshake. Are you there? I'm there. Full stop.
The handshakes reveal MH370 continues to fly for at least 7 hours after it disappeared from air traffic control radar. Yet there were no distress calls.
We were very surprised that the aircraft continued flying without any communication, without any signal. And that only led us to believe the aircraft was flying in a depressurized condition, similar to the Helios flight.
In 2005, the cockpit and cabin of Helios flight 522 failed to pressurize properly after takeoff. The Boeing 737 was en route from Cyprus to Athens when it stopped responding to air traffic control 13 minutes into its flight. Greek authorities scrambled fighter pilots to investigate. They reported seeing passengers and crew slumped unconscious in their seats. The aircraft was flying on autopilot. After 3 hours, it ran out of fuel. It crashed near Athens. None of the 121 people on board survived. An investigation blamed the loss of oxygen on errors made by engineers during maintenance before takeoff. It was also found that the pilots failed to respond to warning alarms in the cockpit. Could MH370 have met a similar fate? A second clue emerges several days after the plane vanished from radar at Agari. It comes from the Malaysian military. A network of powerful military radar was able to track the course of MH370 for an hour after the plane disappeared from air traffic controllers' screens. The radar signals reveal that the aircraft makes a U-turn and flies back over Malaysia. It makes another turn and flies northwest along the Malacca Strait. MH370 then disappears out of military radar range.
Why this U-turn? At that time, they could not know what was the reason. But it was absolutely unexpected.
In animation, Flight 370 banks to the left over cloud cover.
When we first heard that the plane turned around and flew back across the peninsula, that gave us a little bit of hope that the plane kept flying and maybe, you know, it was hijacked. And perhaps, like, there was some, like, terror group that was going to make demands for, like, a ransom or something.
The fact that the plane was still flying meant I had hope that this plane could have landed somewhere else. So, you know, you don't give up hope. You cling on to that hope.
For an aircraft to turn so dramatically off course and then remain in the air for 7 hours is unprecedented. Was this the result of a technical malfunction, or could someone have hijacked the plane?
In a simulation, a pilot pushes forward on the throttle and takes off from a runway.
How could such an aircraft disappear in such a controlled world?
Jean-Luc is a leading expert in air traffic management. He and retired Air France pilot Patrick Blély have worked together for more than 2 years to try and understand what happened on board MH370.
When the disappearance occurred, I was working in Eurocontrol, the organization of the safety of the aviation in Europe, and I thought I could bring something to analyze. What could have happened?
Approaching 6,000, clear to 18,000, and direct to Igari.
With access to a Boeing 777 simulator, the first question they wanted to answer was what caused MH370 to vanish from air traffic control radar at the boundary to Vietnamese airspace.
If someone wants to make this plane disappear from the civilian radar, the only way is to turn off the transponder.
MH370, like all commercial aircraft, was fitted with transponders. These devices communicate the aircraft's position to air traffic control's radar.
The button to turn off the transponder is called a turn knob.
Data received by Malaysian air traffic control indicates the transponders were switched off manually in the cockpit.
And now the aircraft is invisible. This is clever because the choice of the area when the aircraft disappeared is really a black hole between Kuala Lumpur and Vietnam. If you want to disappear, this is where you do it.
MH370 now makes a steeply inclined U-turn to deviate from its flight path. Patrick and Jean-Luc believe this maneuver was carefully planned.
I tried to reproduce this turn to retrace exactly the route that the person at the controls had made. Autopilot off, bank increase to 35, 38 degrees.
Bank increase to 35, 38 degrees.
This U-turn is a very challenging maneuver because he had to make sure that it disappeared quickly from the Vietnamese sector. The controls are shaking because you are at the limit of the aircraft, and the aircraft is telling you, you are asking me a lot. It demands attention and skill. So that's why we believe it was not an accident.
Whoever was at the controls of MH370 then flies beyond the range of military radar. But the plane still has one connection to the outside world.
A satellite.
And this provides the next breakthrough. As Inmarsat scientists analyze the data from the handshakes between the plane and the satellite, they calculate seven boundaries, known as arcs, that MH370 must have crossed. More detailed analysis reveals it turned south after leaving the Strait of Malacca. Scientists then calculate a range of possible flight paths based on the amount of fuel on board. These all end on the seventh arc, a corridor of water in the southern Indian Ocean, more than 2,000 miles from where the search began.
The 17th of March 2014. A plane flies low over open water.
Issue 102, Kabul, maintain 500 feet and request you maintain 1,000.
9 days after MH370 vanished, the Malaysian, Chinese and Australian governments launch a joint search operation.
Australia is responsible for any search and rescue activity in a large portion of the Indian Ocean. And the Australian authorities realised that the aircraft was likely to be in their search and rescue zone, but there was very little position information in relation to where the aircraft had flown. It was only Inmarsat's data that gave us a few clues.
Australia leads the mission as a fleet of 21 aircraft and 19 ships begin searching a 120,000 square mile corridor along the seventh arc.
We were motivated by that one thought, to locate the aircraft and finally give some answers to 239 families.
Crews deploy listening devices, called hydrophones, in water up to 14,000 feet deep. They are designed to detect signals from beacons, known as pingers, attached to the aircraft's black box flight recorders.
It's a race against time with underwater locator beacons. The pingers are water activated and they ping for 30 days or thereabouts.
Recovering the black boxes and retrieving the data inside is the most critical stage in solving any aviation mystery. The data cannot only reveal the fate of an aircraft, but can also result in changes to aircraft design and safety. Locating the black boxes of Air France Flight 447 helped to solve the puzzle of this plane's disappearance back in 2009. The Airbus A330 was travelling from Rio de Janeiro to Paris with 228 passengers and crew on board. Contact was lost 3 hours into the flight, over a remote area of the Atlantic Ocean. An international search team led by the French government located floating pieces of wreckage 5 days after Flight 447 lost contact. Crews began hunting for the black boxes attached to the fuselage, now deep underwater.
The initial search for the underwater pingers was right near the last known point. They hammered that area, listening. But they never heard anything. We had counted on those pingers to tell us if the wreckage was there.
A submersible is lowered into the water.
Crews now had to use sonar equipment to hunt for submerged debris on the seabed 2 miles below. It transmits sound waves which reflect from hard surfaces.
It's like an object just to the top of that grating.
It took 2 years and 5 separate missions to locate the aircraft's fuselage and black boxes.
You can't solve the mystery until you have the black boxes in hand. So the whole team felt like mission accomplished. They had done what they needed to do. You know, they would be able to explain what happened.
A technician is cutting into the black box using a circular saw.
Data and cockpit audio recordings from the black boxes revealed the chain of events that caused Air France Flight 447 to crash. When the aircraft passed through freezing cloud, the sudden change in temperature caused its airspeed sensors to malfunction and the autopilot to switch off.
So the pilots were up at a very high altitude, in the dark, in turbulence, and they were basically faced with having to hand fly the airplane.
The pilots, confused by inaccurate readings from the instruments, pulled the nose up to gain altitude. But this maneuver slowed down the aircraft.
They did not maintain control of the airplane. They pulled the nose up to the point where it stalled.
Air France Flight 447 stalled multiple times. This caused the aircraft to fall for 4.5 minutes until it hit the water at 2:14 a.m.
A military helicopter lands on a runway. A body on a stretcher is carried out.
154 bodies were recovered from the crash site. The investigation led to airspeed sensors on Airbus A330s being updated and pilots receiving additional training to help them fly without autopilot. A combination of technical malfunction and human error downed Flight 447. Could an exceptional chain of events like this have caused MH370 to crash into the Indian Ocean? The aircraft's black boxes may hold the answers. But the search zone is 7 times larger than that of the Air France flight. And in a region renowned for violent storms.
It was hard in every respect. We had hundreds of people who were out a long way from home in at times quite horrendous conditions, particularly in the winter down there. The biggest wave that was measured was 24 metres from peak to trough. And when you're out in weather like that, there's nowhere to run and hide down there.
A violent wave crashes over the deck of a ship in a surge of foaming white surf and sea spray. The 29th of July, 2015.
The first piece of debris from flight MH370 is found 508 days after the aircraft vanished. It's a crucial moment for the search team's lead oceanographer, David Griffin.
A journalist rang me up at 7 o'clock in the morning and said a piece of MH370 has been found on Reunion Island. That's a really big turning point.
The tiny island of La Réunion, just off the coast of Madagascar, lies 2,500 miles west of the search area. A piece of wreckage from a Boeing 777 studded with barnacles has washed ashore. Serial numbers on the metalwork enable French investigators to identify it as a flaperon from the right wing of MH370. Flaperons are sections of wing that move up and down to create drag during takeoff and landing. Does this piece of wreckage, found thousands of miles from the search zone, indicate that they are looking in the right area?
The team were desperate for any sort of information about where they should be searching, otherwise it's based only on the Inmarsat data. And then suddenly we have this extra piece of information, and the search team wanted to know if this extra piece of information could refine the search, but we had a lot of work to do before we could give them that answer.
A man saws part of the wing.
David's team carry out a unique experiment to gather data on how the flaperon moved through the water.
Boeing arranged for us to get hold of a second-hand flaperon, a real 777 flaperon, and we cut that down to match the Reunion flaperon. And then we could see the way that drifted as the weather changed.
The oceanographers use GPS to track the replica flaperon and record how it behaves in different conditions. The data helps them to calculate the point of origin of the real flaperon.
The flaperon was found on Reunion Island. If you could backtrack that, you would get an idea of approximately where on the seventh arc the crash had taken place.
Okay, so it's just flipped. What was the wind speed, Rob? In 20 knots of wind.
David's team combines data from the experiment with computer simulations of ocean currents and winds to reveal the flaperon began its journey on or close to the seventh arc, where the aircraft made its final connection with the Inmarsat satellite.
For the first time, we had proof positive that MH370 had gone down in the Indian Ocean. And in this case, it told us that we were searching roughly in the right place.
Grace.
I remember the day that we learnt of the first piece of debris being found. At that point, some part of my world just came crashing down, seemingly for the second time since the plane disappeared, because this was the first point in time that I had had to, on some level, accept that the plane may have crashed in the southern Indian Ocean. It was a devastating development for me.
That means it was really true that it was in the ocean. I wouldn't say I lost hope, but it was like a feeling went over me and says, he's there.
A bright orange submersible radar unit slides into the water from a ramp on the side of a huge Coast Guard ship.
The official search for MH370 continues for a further 18 months after the flaperon is found. But no trace of the fuselage is located on the seabed. In January 2017, almost 3 years after the plane disappeared, the Australian, Malaysian, and Chinese governments suspend the underwater search.
The search was shut down because governments had agreed to search 120,000 square kilometres and we searched 120,000 square kilometres. We felt very frustrated and somewhat angry when the search was wound up. We still believed right up to the last day that had we continued, we would have been successful.
The cost of the operation has reached almost £120 million. Around 20 million more than the total spent to find Air France Flight 447. The Australian, Malaysian, and Chinese governments say they will only resume the search for MH370 if credible new evidence for its location comes to light.
When they stopped, it was like somebody put a pin into the balloon and then, okay, that's it. They might say, it's a very expensive search, but the families deserve answers. How are we supposed to put X marks a spot that's where it is? Who's going to send a message to you from the aircraft? We are here. Come on. No one can do that.
A bustling neon-lit city street in Bangkok, Thailand. A white man wearing almost all beige clothes and a fedora walks down a road.
The mystery that surrounds the aircraft's disappearance inspires amateur sleuths to pick up the trail after the official investigation comes to a halt. They include lawyer Blaine Gibson.
I got pulled in deeper to Malaysia 370 as the search went on and the plane was not found. I love adventure and solving mysteries, and I thought I could be out there looking for debris, and maybe finding a piece of this plane could help lead to finding the truth and the rest of it.
Inside a dimly lit room, Blaine unzips a large rainbow-colored plastic bag. He takes out a piece of debris from inside and turns it over to reveal a white panel surface.
I am convinced this is from Malaysian 370, and I know a piece of the plane when I see it.
After the flaperon is found, Blaine consults Australian oceanographers who confirm that the coast of Mozambique is a likely location to find more debris from the plane.
I felt like I needed to get involved because I saw something that nobody was doing and needed to be done, and I realized that I could do it myself. I went to Vilanculos, which is on the Mozambique Channel. I asked around, where do local people go and find things washed ashore? And I was told that there was a sandbank that local fishermen would go to get nets from the open Indian Ocean, and that would be the best place to go. So we arrived on the sandbank and we walked around for, I guess, 20 minutes. And that's where I found my first piece of debris, no step.
A photograph of the debris found on the beach.
And it had no step stenciled written on it. It was the no step that I have seen written on airplanes that told me that this was definitely from an aircraft. And when I held it in my hands, I could feel that it was from the airplane I was looking for. It was not a feeling of happiness. However, I did feel a sense of accomplishment.
Blaine sent the piece to Australian investigators for analysis. They confirmed it's almost certainly part of the horizontal stabilizer on the tail of a Boeing 777. There is only one 777 missing in the Indian Ocean, so the no-step piece could only come from MH370.
After Mozambique, I went to Madagascar. I went to Riake Beach and found three pieces of debris on that day. The most moving to me is the monitor case, which is the case around the television on the back of the seat in front of you in economy class.
Blaine has collected more than half of all the floating debris that's believed to be from MH370. 18 of the 22 pieces he's located are included as evidence in the official report into the missing plane. The debris not only provides evidence about where the aircraft may have crashed, but also how it crashed.
All of the 22 pieces of debris that I have found and collected from local people say one thing to me. They say that this plane tragically shattered on impact.
Blaine and the Australian investigation team believe the shattered debris is evidence that the plane did not make a controlled ditching onto the water.
We found a lot of debris in small pieces, which indicates a fair bit of energy at impact.
Nothing in the debris speaks as to who was flying the plane or why. But the debris tells us something about what happened to the plane. It crashed high speed. And where? Southern Indian Ocean.
The shattered debris is crucial evidence as to the fate of the plane. But it's not enough to pinpoint a precise location on the seabed to retrieve the fuselage or the black box data recorders.
An aerial view of Frankfurt, Germany.
10 years after MH370 vanished, some investigators refuse to give up.
In my mind, there's no aviation mystery that cannot be solved. I got involved as soon as MH370 had happened. I've been working 8 hours a day for most days for the last 10 years.
Retired aerospace engineer Richard Godfrey has worked with NASA, Boeing, and Airbus. He's among a handful of volunteer experts whose research into MH370 has been acknowledged by official investigators. Now, Richard's using pioneering technology to try to locate the aircraft.
Aircraft do not vanish. They always leave a trail of breadcrumbs. That might be a trail of physical evidence or a trail of electronic evidence. Very thorough searches led us, in some sense, to the end of a road. So the question then is, have we missed something? And I thought maybe there is the opportunity to find MH370 from other data that we have not considered. We know the last position of MH370 in the Strait of Malacca. The question is, where did it go from there? There's no radar coverage of the Indian Ocean, but there are radio signals.
Richard believes he's found evidence for MH370's flight path hidden in a database of radio signals called Weak Signal Propagation Reporter, or WSPR for short.
I think I have a good idea of where the crash location is, and that is because of WSPR.
WSPR is designed to test the strength of radio frequencies. Every 2 minutes, transmitters around the world send thousands of low-power radio pulses. They can travel vast distances, even across oceans. Richard believes he can use these signals to find MH370.
When an aircraft crosses a radio signal, it will disturb this radio signal.
Every WSPR signal sent is stored in a database. This allows Richard to examine the profiles of all the radio signals that crossed the Indian Ocean on March 8, 2014. He searches for minute disturbances in the signals that he believes are traces of MH370.
I picked up a disturbance in the middle of the Indian Ocean on the night that MH370 disappeared. And then I picked it up again. Sort of a eureka moment.
Richard has now pinpointed 130 disturbances in the WSPR signals over the Indian Ocean. He is confident these are evidence of MH370's final flight path. The disturbances terminate at a point just outside of the seventh arc, in an area not covered by any underwater search to date.
From the data, I can put a circle on a map with a radius of 30 kilometers. I think we have not found MH370 simply because we didn't look wide enough from the seventh arc.
What could have caused the aircraft to crash outside of the seventh arc, beyond the point where investigators calculated it would have run out of fuel?
I saw in my analysis that MH370 definitely made several turns, but it also made changes to altitude, changes to speed. That implies to me that there was a pilot, an active pilot, right until the end of the flight.
If MH370 was flown manually at the point it ran out of fuel, then whoever was at the controls may have been able to glide the plane to take it beyond the seventh arc. Richard is not alone in believing that the plane was piloted until it crashed.
We are convinced that only an experienced pilot could do it. He took care to be invisible, not traceable, to not be followed.
From their investigations, air traffic management expert Jean-Luc Marchand and pilot Patrick Blély have concluded a skilled pilot was in control from the moment MH370 disappeared off radar until it crashed around 7 hours later. To keep the plane hidden, they believe the person at the controls shut off power to MH370's satellite phones, leaving crew with no way to contact the ground.
The captain has the power to switch off all the equipment on board, even the cabin pressure.
Pilots can manually override a plane's automatic air pressurization system in case there's a technical malfunction.
The problem was that the passengers, the crew, were going to find that the plane was no longer on its way to Beijing. So my theory is that MH370 was depressurized.
Depressurization.
It is quite easy for a pilot to depressurize an aircraft. All you have to do is switch the pressurization valves to manual.
When a plane depressurizes, air is sucked out of the cabin. Emergency oxygen masks would have enabled passengers to survive for around 20 minutes. But equipment in the cockpit would give a pilot access to more than 20 hours of oxygen.
Patrick explains. This made it possible to neutralize all the people who were in the cabin. The person who took control of this plane did something extraordinary, which led to the deaths of 239 people on board this plane and put it at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. And we don't know why he did that. We have no idea why. I am convinced this was executed by someone who was a pilot, because no one else was capable on this plane.
Personne d'autre n'était en capacité dans cet avion.
A streak of pale orange sky as the sun rises over the vast Indian Ocean, which stretches all the way to the horizon.
The passenger and crew manifests show there were only two qualified pilots on board MH370. Both were in the cockpit from the moment the aircraft left the gate. First Officer Farik Abdul Hamid was 27 years old and on his final training flight. His superior, Captain Zahari Ahmed Shah, had been with Malaysia Airlines for 30 years.
Hi everyone.
Captain Zahari posted videos on his YouTube channel featuring a homemade flight simulator. When investigators examined data from the simulator, they found evidence of what may have been a deleted flight path from Kuala Lumpur to the south of the Indian Ocean. If MH370 was hijacked and crashed by one of its pilots, it would not be the first time that this has happened to a commercial aircraft.
Footage of a plane taking off into an overcast sky.
In 2015, a Germany's flight from Barcelona, destined for Dusseldorf, was being piloted by the first officer, Andreas Lubitz, who had a history of mental illness, had actually been advised by his doctor that he was not fit to fly. However, he did not disclose that to his airline.
The Airbus A320 was cruising at 38,000 feet. When the senior pilot left the cockpit to use the bathroom, co-pilot Andreas Lubitz was left alone at the controls. He locked the cockpit door and pointed the nose down into a steady descent. Black box data reveals audio of the senior pilot attempting to break down the cockpit door. Lubitz can be heard breathing heavily as he steers the plane downwards.
Too low, terrain. Pull up. Terrain ahead. Pull up.
The aircraft crashed in the French Alps, hitting the ground at 430 miles per hour. All 150 people on board were killed. Cases like this are classified as mass murder-suicide.
German Wings was a watershed moment. It lifted the lid on pilot mental health. A lot of people thought that this was the first case of a pilot ever destroying his aircraft intentionally. However, this was not the case. Over the last 40 years, there's been 9 or 10 fatal accidents that have been attributed to the deliberate destruction of the airplane by the pilot.
Since 2014, there's been one confirmed case of mass murder-suicide by a pilot and two crashes which may have been caused by the deliberate actions of pilots, including MH370. If proven, these incidents would bring the number of people intentionally killed by pilot suicide in the last decade to 521. That would be around a fifth of all the deaths in commercial aviation over the last 10 years, according to figures from the International Civil Aviation Organization. What can be done to prevent incidents of pilot suicide?
Although aviation is ultra-safe in terms of modes of transport, at the moment, the dashboard is lighting up that there's a problem. There are people flying who shouldn't be flying.
Paul is a professional pilot and researcher in psychology at Trinity College Dublin. His team has carried out one of the world's most detailed studies into the mental health of flight crew.
We surveyed over 1,000 pilots. And of those 1,000 pilots, we found that 17% were meeting the threshold for moderate depression. We also found that 35% of pilots were meeting the threshold for burnout. Burnout is characterized by cynicism towards their job, emotional exhaustion, and reduced professional efficacy. None of those should ever be in a cockpit of an airplane.
More than half of the pilots who took part in Paul's study reported they are concerned about their mental health. That's a larger proportion than among the wider UK population, where the figure is closer to 1 in 4.
The industry has changed dramatically over the last 25 years. People speak of the race to the bottom, where ticket prices are getting cheaper year on year. The fuel is staying pretty much consistent, the cost of the airplanes is staying pretty much consistent, and it's the staff that have been hit. The hours we work are far more intense, and our data suggests that that is having an impact on the mental health of pilots.
Paul believes the aviation industry must develop new ways to identify and support frontline staff who need help.
It's not very easy for a pilot to put his hand up and admit that he has a problem, because once he puts his hand up and admits he has a mental health issue, his medical will be revoked, which will suspend his license, and he can't fly. The system has to change. That fear of putting their hand up to say, I'm not okay, that fear has to be removed. And I sincerely hope that we learn that lesson in aviation.
A plane takes off from a runway and rises into a cloudy grey sky. Now a sunrise shines over the undulating waters of a vast ocean.
In the case of MH370, there's no evidence that either pilot was affected by poor mental health. Their families maintain their innocence, and there is no proof that they were involved in the plane's disappearance. The best chance of finding out what happened to MH370 is to recover the data recordings from the cockpit, locked in the black boxes at the bottom of the Indian Ocean.
I'm absolutely convinced it will only take one more search and we will find MH370.
Can Richard Godfrey's research using radio signals provide the new evidence needed to initiate another deep sea search? His technique has never been used to locate a missing plane before. But now, scientists at the University of Liverpool are undertaking a major study to verify how viable the technology is.
I'm hopeful we'll find MH370. It's completely conceivable that Whisper works. It's not yet proven. Proving whether Whisper works is what we're trying to do now.
Simon Maskell builds algorithms to solve complex problems. He helped design a system to track the spread of COVID-19 in the UK. Now he's creating a computer system to analyse the effect that thousands of aircraft have on the profile of low-power radio signals.
What we want to do is to use all the data globally from all the aeroplanes that are flying in a day, and that will give us several times as much data as Richard has previously been able to consider.
The system will attempt to track every plane in the sky over a 24-hour period. If it achieves a high success rate, it will be compelling evidence that Whisper can be used to detect aircraft over long distances.
I'm hopeful we should know whether Whisper provides information pertinent to MH370 in the next 6 months or so. If Whisper works, then we'll know where MH370 was when it hit the ocean and therefore where it is now, and then we can go and get it, and that would be a great day.
In animation, the flight path of Malaysia 370 terminates in a red circle just beyond the seventh arc in the southern Indian Ocean. Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Nathan.
10 years down the line, now we have this new information from WSPR, Whisper, which also generally ties in with the seventh arc and what generally has been believed to be the end point of the plane. We know the plane is somewhere there. If you keep searching, you'll find it.
10 years on, I would say that the overriding feeling has been a feeling of disappointment, betrayal, and of course, frustration and anger as well. Until we solve MH370, there's nothing to say that you or one of your loved ones will take to the skies one day and never return. We'll just vanish into thin air, because that's essentially what has happened to MH370.
Jaquita lights a candle by a small shrine dedicated to her lost husband.
8th of March will never be wiped out from my memory, because every year we relive it. I haven't had a memorial for Patrick. I've got nothing of him that has come back to me in order to say that it's all over. I just want to know that they are there. Okay, then I can have a memorial for him. I just want closure.
Most families of missing passengers and crew accepted compensation and final settlements from Malaysia Airlines. On Sunday, the 3rd of March 2024, the Malaysian government announced it's considering resuming the underwater search for the plane. Deep sea exploration company Ocean Infinity has proposed searching on a no-find, no-fee basis. They're collecting research from Captain Patrick Blelly, Jean-Luc Marchand and Richard Godfrey.
In 2003, millions watched the space shuttle that fell to Earth. Press Red now for our heartbreaking documentary on iPlayer. And working at the forefront of forensic science, a grisly discovery for the real CSI. The new series tomorrow night at 9 on BBC Two.